Hello from Ellensburg, Washington, USA. This is the Nick Zettner Geology Podcast, episode 118. Hey man, where have you been? Thanks for listening. Well, I think that's you talking to me, and rightly so. You're asking me, where have I been? How come I haven't done one of these frickin' things since early November? And my answer is, I've been busy. And you're like, teaching classes, is that it? Blah, blah, blah. You know, you guys don't work that hard at a state university. Well, you're right. We don't work that hard. Guilty. But I did a YouTube live stream series, 26 episodes, The Ice Age Floods, A to Z. And if you do remember, the episode before this one, back in November, I announced that I was going to be doing that. And I probably said something back in November like, hey, you're not going to hear much from me until springtime. Well, here it is. It's March 12th, my favorite time of the year. College basketball, green grass, flowers starting to come out, birds chirping, Bijou the cat outside, the whole thing. And the dark days of winter are behind us at least one more year. So we made it. So this episode, I think that I want to describe what happened over the winter time. I think I'd like to share some of the high points of the winter series, just without thinking about it a whole lot. You know, I like to do these spontaneously. I don't like to plan too much. Plus, I want to set up what's going to be happening in a few weeks. I can't say 2 months now. It's coming up pretty quickly. So let's get to that right now. I have announced more than once that I'm doing 3 brand new lectures in person in downtown Ellensburg, Washington, and you're invited. Even if you never watch the YouTube stuff, even if you never see the PBS stuff, if it's just you listening to these and you want to come visit with me in person, I'm giving 3 lectures on 3 consecutive nights in early April. I think it's April 4th, April 5th, and April 6th of 2024. If it's not those actual dates, it's the first Thursday, Friday, and Saturday of the month of April. It's right after Easter Sunday, let's put it that way. And the auditorium is called the Morgan Performing Arts Center. It's essentially a fancy name for the Morgan Middle School. On First Avenue in downtown Ellensburg, but this is not the first time I've done a downtown lecture. There's I think 30 or more of them by now. I started doing these 15 years ago. And I not only do an in-person lecture with some relatively fast-paced geology, half of it chalkboard and half of it visuals on a big screen, but I have them recorded. I have them videotaped. And then I post those on my YouTube channel. And in the olden days, Central Washington University used to post them on their YouTube channel as well. But that doesn't happen anymore. It's just me. I'm just a solo cat now. And so you are invited to come to these lectures. And you're like, oh, is it like the same lecture 3 nights in a row? No, it's not. Instead, I am trying to figure out currently, this week I'm starting to get serious about it, how can I take 26 long live episodes devoted to the Ice Age floods, where I learned all sorts of new things on my own and from the viewers. And how can I boil that down to 3 hours? Basically take a whole winter's worth of programs and get it down to the greatest hits. So they will be 3 different lectures, 3 new lectures. And I think they're going to stand alone. Okay, new thought right now. Thank you for listening to this, dear listener. If you were involved all winter, and you know exactly what I'm talking about, and you were involved with Google Earth by Glenn and the Eugene team and Vic Baker and Richard Waite and Jim O'Connor and Jerome Lessman and Kelsey Stanton, we're looking at Puget ice sheet deposits of different generations, and we're looking, what the hell happened to the Spokane ice sheet? And if you knew about Glacial Lake Missoula, and you You remember us talking about Joseph Pardee and Thomas Large and T.C. Chamberlain, and the list goes on and on. The Lewis Hills. I mean, there's a Grand Coulee, Moses. I can't stop. If you're familiar with all that stuff we were doing, I think I have an ask. And that's in keeping with what I was doing this winter. Now I'm suddenly talking to the folks who are unaware of what has been happening this winter. I did 26 episodes. Each episode had a title. I was doing a mixture of talking into the camera from my office live, but then I had multiple cameras, so I'd go to a document camera and look at an old document. I've got slides ready to go. I've got a Zoom interview I can do with somebody. It was a varied format, and it was the latest iteration of this alphabet format that I've used the last few winters. I was leaning probably, can I say that? Yeah, I think for the first time this past winter, I was directly going to the live viewers regularly. For instance, I would say, well, you know, I've been meaning to learn about Alonzo Troth. He taught science at Lewis and Clark High School in Spokane in the 19-teens and the 1920s, but I haven't been able to find much on him. Viewers, do you think you could find a few things on Alonzo Troth? Maybe a quick biology, or sorry, a quick kind of a biography timeline for him? Can we find a couple photos? Where did he grow up? And you're like, well, you did what? You started asking the audience for help? Yeah. And I got an incredible amount of help from items big and small, old rare photos that nobody had seen. Permission to share field notes from the University of Chicago Library. I'm pausing because there's too many to count here. So my point here is that I kind of stumbled into a new thing, even though this is not the first time I've taught geology publicly or shared a geology outreach video or whatever. It was the first time I was consistently going to the audience for assistance, and I learned so much more by doing that. So I'm pausing because I'm going to come to you right now. And you're like, you're coming to me? I'm just sitting in rush hour traffic. I'm not doing a damn thing for you, man. Totally respect that. That's fine. But if you were involved the whole winter, and you know exactly what we were up to, I'm a little bit stuck right now, and I'm wondering if I could get a few emails from some of you, just a few of you, with some ideas to potentially get me unstuck. I wasn't planning on this, but that's always fun, when we can kind of stumble into an idea fresh and in the moment. So, what's my email address? What's my name? Well, my name is in the title of the podcast, right? Nick Zentner. So you can find that. That's how you spell it. And then my email address is nick@geology.cwu.edu. Get it? CWU, that's for Central Washington University. EDU, that's for education. Okay, so that's my email. So if you feel like it, and you listen to this audio podcast, and you like want to contribute a couple of ideas. What am I asking you for? I'm asking you for ideas on how I can group the material. I'm a bit stuck. So this morning, really the first morning, I got up early and sat with Bijou, and it's dark outside, and there's the garbage truck outside and making a big clatter and everything. And I had a little bit of a breakthrough. So I think one of the lectures, maybe the first of the three lectures, will be called What Happened to the Spokane Ice Sheet? And I think that I will devote that hour to how North American geologists have found multiple generations of glacial deposits. In other words, proving that the ice sheet from Canada crossed the border and got down into the lower 48 not just once, but multiple times during the last 2.6 million years. But instead of just doing a broad lecture on that, I want to steer it towards what we know about multiple ice advances over Seattle. And then ultimately, the goal of the lecture will be to talk about evidence that we had multiple ice advances in the Spokane, Washington area, which is in eastern Washington. And you're like, well, that's a pretty radical thought. I don't think I've heard that anywhere. Well, that's right. You haven't. And I probably did some audio podcasts on this last spring or last summer when I was deep in the zone with this stuff. But I'm still there. I wasn't backed off of that throughout the entire alphabet. And so you're like, okay, wait a minute. What am I supposed to email you? Well, I'm not sure I'm going to stick with that as the one of the lectures, but I don't know what to do with the other two lectures. I'm looking for some sort of natural theme that comes out. And here's the problem. Every time I think to myself, well, that'll be easy. I'll just like do maybe one of the lectures will just be like Bretz's life, J. Harlan Bretz's life. I've got all these photos and where he lived in Seattle, and I can just have it just be a slideshow. Well, as soon as I mentally go there, and I've been doing that the last few days, you know, I'll sit there like staring at a wall and go, I can just do that. I can just do a Bretz timeline lecture. Then I remember that I really like the format of the downtown lectures, where I do full 30 minutes of chalkboard, multiple chalkboards, fast-paced, walking around, chalk, erase, go to the next board, chalk, erase, go back and forth, animated, chalk dust flying, my pants are getting full of dust. I like that. And that's very true to my whole teaching career. I've worked with chalkboards my whole life. It's a dying thing. But I still have value in it, and people remember it. That's almost a gimmick. Oh, yeah, I saw that. Wait, you saw this lecture on how the Rocky Mountains formed? This is somebody talking to somebody else downtown. Oh, yeah, I saw this guy on YouTube. It's like, well, which one is it? Is it like the guy with the weird hat and he's got the beard? No, it's got this guy with the chalkboards up there. Oh, yeah, oh, a chalkboard guy. Yeah, I know who that is. I've seen one. I've seen a couple of those. So that's where I'm stuck. I need three lectures that have chalkboard work for half of it, and then I can go to the visuals. So I can't just do a Bretz story hour, because I don't see how I can do Bretz's life on a chalkboard. Maybe I can, but I don't think so. So that's where I'm asking for your help. Maybe you have some ideas, some fresh ideas that I don't have. I'm just going to workshop a few more ideas right now with you. Maybe I can do something with, well, let me share the four open questions that I was working on all winter. And I'm pleased with it. I think I got to all four of those open questions regularly. It's not like I did it once. So way back at the beginning of the alphabet, and before Thanksgiving, I had four questions that I wanted to work on. Number one, are we sure that all the Ice Age floods came from Montana? Number two, are we sure that all the Ice Age floods are younger than 30,000 years old? Number three, how much of the Ice Age history is locked into the Luce Hills of southeastern Washington? And number four, who influenced and what influenced J. Harlan Bretz before his arrival in eastern Washington in 1922? Those were the four questions. And I've got 3-hour lectures to do, and I don't know. I don't think I have a full hour on Luce. I don't think I have a full hour on, oh shit, maybe I do have a full, all right. Okay, what am I going to do with you here? I'm daydreaming again right now. I'm supposed to be doing an entertaining podcast. I don't know how entertaining these things are. They're more of a behind-the-scenes commentary, sometimes brainstorming sessions, and I guess that's what this one's going to turn out to be. So here's another thing I've been trying to get unstuck. I've just been trying to just write down on blank sheets of paper things that I thought were particularly memorable and new. Because the context for this is, most everybody now who likes geology has heard the Missoula flood story, and they've heard the J. Harlan Brett story. And I have no interest in telling that story. I could easily do 3-hour lectures on the Missoula floods. I have done that for years in my classes, and even in the downtown lecture, I did lectures on the Missoula floods. But I need to really focus on the new material, and much of the new material that nobody knows, not even the most veteran Ice Age floods geologists. It was new to them. Like what? Well, all of the field notes written by J. Harlan Bretz himself, typed up at the end of each field season, those typed field notes by J. Harlan Bretz in the summer of 1922, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 1929, 1930. No, not 30. 29 was his last field season out here. J. Harlan Bretz came out every summer and spent a month to 6 weeks, sometimes even longer, on foot, riding the rails, and eventually his own family car, a Dodge 4 Squareback, getting around the channeled scablands of eastern Washington, getting up to southern British Columbia, getting over to western Montana, nosing around Lake Ponderay, down at the Snake River, where it intersects with the Palouse River, Palouse Falls, Dry Falls, Moses Coulee, Grand Coulee, Potholes Coulee, Frenchman Coulee, Wallula Gateway, Portland, Beacon Rock, the mouth of the... This guy was everywhere. And those notes had been under lock and key at the University of Chicago for 100 years. And those notes, those beautiful, meticulous field notes written by J. Harlan Bretz, have been residing at the University of Chicago for 100 years. And the only way to access those notes was to literally make the pilgrimage to Chicago, sit in a room, put the white gloves on, whatever. Take your notes of his notes. Or I guess you could get permission to take your camera in there and snap a few photos, or maybe your iPhone in the last few years. But I knew about those notes, and I wondered if I could somehow figure out how to get permission to share those notes on my website, nickzentner.com. If you haven't been there before, you're welcome to go right now. nickzentner.com. You click, look in the upper right, you can click on the word floods. Next to that is the word Bretz. If you click on either of those words, Bretz or floods, you have dozens, maybe hundreds, of documents and papers that were compiled carefully over the course of this winter. Easily the most impressive and exciting of those documents are these actual notes. You're like, well, how did you get permission? Well, the viewers. The viewers were making requests. They got permission to make scans of certain things. Ryan from Springfield, Illinois, drove all the way up to Chicago for a day, sat in the room, took photo after photo, and then emailed the photos to me. Brian from Portland, Oregon, somehow figured out how to convince the library staff to scan a bunch of the Brett's notes for him, and then he emailed them to me. And then right before the live stream series was about to begin in November, I got a semi-sad email from University of Chicago. Sad is wrong. Like, they were kind of warning me, like, look, you don't have permission. There's copyright on these notes, even though they're almost 100 years old. You don't have permission to post these things. You need actual permission from the family of J. Harlan Bretz to allow us to give you permission to post all these notes. Even though your intentions are good, you're posting it away from the University of Chicago. That's a no-no. The only way out of this is for you to connect and get permission from a descendant of J. Harlan Bretz. Well, what did I do in the next live stream? I asked the viewers, can anybody help me? Can anybody help me out? Can somebody figure out how to find a living descendant of J. Harlan Brentz? And if you had a email address, that'd be even icing on the cake. And the viewers came through. And I started emailing with a number of descendants of J. Harlan Brentz, including his great-grandson, who ultimately said, I would be happy to give you permission to do this. Let me talk to the University of Chicago people and make sure that that's okay. And it happened. That's just one example, maybe the most exciting example. That's one example of how these viewers rallied behind what was going on and saw a way to specifically contribute. Okay, here's a tangent. You know, this whole YouTube thing started in the pandemic in March of 2020, which is exactly 4 years ago. And I taught myself how to use my phone to live stream on YouTube. And I started to build an audience. And that was easy to do back then because everybody was trapped at home and we were all slightly freaking out and bored and scared and emotional. And so we had this rather genuine, loyal community. And I was live streaming 5 days a week just to keep myself sane, using kitchen props and all sorts of things. And Bijou the Cat was a major character. And I did 75 of those in the spring of 2020. Well, a bunch of that community still remains. And the reason I go back to 2020 is that as I continued into the fall of 2020, when we were still locked down, for the most part, people were receiving so much from me that they had a tangible, driven reason to reciprocate. And because I was so weird about money and I never wanted to have any subscriptions or donations or Patreon or anything like that, I was just worried about doing it that way. Because I was not into the money thing, people just started sending stuff to the house. They're sending bottles of wine and sending food props and sending equipment and things to help with the live streams. They wanted to give back somehow. And so that was a strange time. And so I was like sharing all the gifts just because I felt like it added to the community. But here we are a few years later. And I think that core relationship that I have with the audience remains. They still want to give back somehow. But they know that money is not an option. And they know that I'm not live streaming from home anymore, so they're not really sending a bunch of stuff to the house, which is fine by me. But this is a new way that they can give back. And it's not just giving back, but it's literally being a major contributor to the learning community. And I don't know of anybody else doing this, to be honest. And I don't know how much anybody else will notice, but it feels new and rare. And the Brentz thing is just one example. Somehow I need to get that learner community, that viewer community, into the three new lectures. I'm just not quite sure how to do it. I want those three lectures to be geology-based. I don't want it to be like, here's what I did over my Christmas vacation. And aren't I wonderful? And I had out so many views. And I don't want that. So it needs to be geology-based, but I to hit it as hard as I can directly with you. Viewers, if you want to email me, can you put in the subject line idea, just the word idea? That would tip me off that you're talking about, you listen to this audio episode. Or ideas, plural, I guess. And you're giving me lecture ideas. And however you want to run with that is fine. I think I'm mainly asking for three lecture titles. And if you can kind of see naturally where the three lecture titles would be, geology-based, then it's up to me to fold the Brett stuff in, to fold the Flint stuff in, to fold the Pardee, all these human stories and journal articles and influences of Brits and other things. That's up to me. But just structuring it, I'm still a little bit stuck with those three episodes. I'll give you a little bit more geology before we finish. I learned a lot this winter about marine isotope. Wow. I learned a lot this winter about marine isotope stage records, which I still can't even say apparently, but there's a record in the oceans to give us a good idea for climate variability over the last 2.6 million years. And that leads to some interesting ideas involving not all of those cold times in the Ice Age were equal. And by looking at those marine records, it's clear to some that four of the biggest, coldest glacial times were recent in the last 500,000 years, and even younger than that. Marine isotope stage 2, 20,000 years ago. Stage 6, 130,000 years ago. Stage 12 and stage 16. I can't remember those dates. But Joel Gombiner from the University of Washington clued me into the idea that maybe those four mega glaciations correspond to four mega flood times. And if we truly do have Ice Age floods of four different ages, or at least multiple ages, doesn't it make the most sense to naturally go to those four mega glacial times first? Stage 2, stage 6, stage 12, stage 16. We kind of lost that narrative as the alphabet went on. I learned that there's lots of different generations of loess, wind-blown silt in the Palouse Hills, but only the upper few layers of loess have been studied carefully. And there are lots and lots of loess deposits that are significantly older than stage 6. That can be worked on. We became preoccupied with the Spokane, Washington area and the deposits, the Pleistocene deposits, both north, south, east, and west of Spokane itself, and realized that back 100 years ago, Bretz and Flint were convinced that the ice sheet, the Spokane ice sheet, was big enough to cover the city of Spokane and even get further south. And to have that ice sitting right on the channel heads of the channeled scablands. And if you get that ice back to where it belongs, according to those two gentlemen who spent clearly the most time in the field out there, then you suddenly are not talking about Glacial Lake Missoula as the source of water. You're talking about water coming directly from the ice sheet somehow and dumping right into those major channels, the most famous of which is the Grand Coulee, but there are other channels as well. The Cheney Palouse Track, the Telford Crab Creek Track, the Grand Coulee, Moses Coulee, and the Columbia Valley itself downstream of Chelan. I could go on, but the idea is there has been rich new work that has been unearthed, not only with the field notes, but letters, personal letters between these geologists, which were my personal favorites. I mean, the field notes themselves are amazing, but to sit in and listen to these conversations between Bretz and Flint, between Bretz and Pardee, between Pardee and Thomas Large, between Thomas Large and Flint, and so on, and so on, and so on. It brings to life what it was like to be in the field in eastern Washington in the 1920s and the 1930s. And one of the biggest things that we discovered together is that many of those narratives of the Spokane ice sheet and these older, bigger floods versus younger, smaller floods, many of those narratives among some geologists do not continue today. And it's primarily because those geologists are not with us anymore. I'm starting to see that it's not like we've had major new discoveries to totally disprove those older ideas of ice over Spokane or subglacial flow being the main driver for many of the Ice Age flood events. It's not like we've just found a bunch of new stuff to discredit it. The narrative has just simply shifted. Because a new crop of geologists showed up in the 1960s, some of whom are still with us, and those narratives have strayed significantly from the original narratives of the Channeled Scablands. Ultimately, I was just asking the audience all winter, are we sure we should get away from those old narratives? If we really just count up the number of field days in eastern Washington of J. Harlan Brett's, and to count the field days of Flint, and count the field days of Pardee, those guys are in the field 10 times, 100 times as many days as some of these field geologists in the last 50 years. Isn't that important? You're like, no, that's not important. It doesn't matter how long you're out there. It just depends on how interesting your questions are and how many cool tools you have. Well, I don't know about that. Brett's in particular knew what glacial deposits look like because he's cut his teeth on those in Michigan, and then he became very familiar with the look of glacial deposits in Seattle and the Puget Sound. Then Brett shows up in eastern Washington, and he's seen glacial deposits again south of Spokane, Washington. And now suddenly we're supposed to say the guy doesn't know what he's talking about? That there clearly isn't any evidence of ice-deposited material in the Spokane area? I find that hard to believe. And I found it hard to believe 6 months ago, and I fully expected over the course of the winter that I would have geologists watching, some of the most well-respected geologists, Pleistocene geologists, and I fully expected at some point many of those geologists would say, yeah, you're wrong. You thought that old stuff was maybe right, and it's clearly wrong because of this and this and this and this and this. But you know the punchline? Vic Baker and Jim O'Connor and Richard Waite and others, Brian Atwater, they are not eager to get away from the old days and the old work. And yet it's not in the narratives today. So to me, that remains the most fascinating thing about this past winter. Old work, forgotten work, not read very much these days, it still might be the most important and reliable work that's been done on the Ice Age floods in the Pacific Northwest. Where have I been? I've been in my office doing two live streams a week, and some of those episodes ballooned to more than 3 hours. Individual episodes, more than 3 hours. There was so much to share and learn. I think that's enough for today. It's good to be back with you, dear listener. I hope to continue to get in the flow with these audio podcasts this spring, and especially as I get closer and closer to the downtown lectures happening in early April in Ellensburg, Washington, USA. Thank you. I love you. And goodbye. From where? Ellensburg, Washington, USA.